Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. My name's Marshall Poe, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the network. And occasionally, I like to get back in front of the microphone and do an interview or two. I have a different role in the network, but again, I really enjoy talking to authors. And when I saw Sereika Davis's book, Renaissance Ethnography and the Invention of the Human, New World Maps and Monsters, I said to myself, I have to do that one. Part of the reason is that I wrote a book about, I don't know if it had the words Renaissance ethnography in it or not. I think it did. Many years ago, it was about Europeans who traveled to Russia, and I thought of them as ethnographers, so I was glad to see somebody else, Sereika, and in this case, thinking of them as ethnographers. And so I just said to myself, I have to read this book and talk to this woman. So Sereika, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. Perhaps you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a historian of early modern Europe and Europeans exploring the world between about 1400 and 1850. I trained as a historian of science, but the reason I did that is what I really wanted to do is be an intergalactic explorer. So I grew up on far too much Star Trek Next Generation, far too much Deep Space Nine, far too much Carl Sagan, and actually went up to university to be an astronaut. Not that I admitted to that. But, you know, as we all figured out that we couldn't invent warp drive fast enough, many of us defected to subjects like history of science. And so I work on the history of exploration and cultural encounters from the comfort of my armchair rather than being scrunched up in a tiny little pod. I mean, I don't even like camping. So I'm very happy as cultural historian.
Now, I don't know if you live in Connecticut, but you teach in Connecticut. Are you from Connecticut originally?
No, I'm not.
Facetiously.
I live and work in Connecticut. I teach at Western Connecticut State University. I moved from the UK about 4 years ago, so all my training is there. But given my interest in early modern exploration, particularly of the Americas, it was clear that I was going to have very exciting conversations as I worked to revise the book of my dissertation by, you know, crossing the Atlantic myself. It's almost the Stanislavski method of doing history.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're perfectly suited to write about this stuff. I was not. I'm from Kansas. Now that you've lived in the States for a while, you probably know where that is, and it's, I guess you'd call it the Midlands or something in the UK.
Yeah.
I'd never gone anywhere. Oklahoma was a long way for me. So anyway, you are much better suited than I was to write this book, and that's probably why it's a much better book. So tell us why you wrote it. I mean, I guess you kind of given us an introduction into that, but if you could explain specifically why Renaissance ethnography and the invention of the human.
Sure. So when I was an undergraduate in the history of science and we had to pick a dissertation topic, it was obvious to me that I was going to work on something to do with the history of exploration. And that moment of Europeans encountering peoples in a region that they had never explored before was very attractive. So that's what I did as an undergraduate. When it came to thinking up a project for my PhD, I was at the time a curator at the British Library in the Map Library. I still knew I wanted to work on European encounters with the peoples of the Americas. And one of the kind of methods that had really kind of sunk into my brain as an undergraduate was that of historical anthropology, the work of many early modern cultural historians who focused on strange stuff, you know, the seemingly irrational elements of culture, the jokes, the rituals, the kind of peculiar behavior, the impersonations. And I'm thinking, of course, of work by people like Natalie Zeman Davis, The Return of Martin Guerre. Perhaps it was that Star Trek training as well. I was interested in what looking at things that don't make sense can tell us about societies. And so as a curator, when I saw images of peoples of the Americas, giants in Patagonia, cannibals in Brazil, headless men and Amazons in Guyana, I thought, oh, I wonder what they were reading. I wonder why those images are there. And I also noticed that historians of cartography ignored these images. As far as they were concerned, images were either political propaganda or decoration. There were no other options. But it seemed to me that we didn't know until we looked. We needed to analyze these images, and we needed to read very widely the travel text and look at the images and the sources from this period, and then figure out what these images were doing. And so what I went into this book looking to do when it was a dissertation was to learn about the history of reading travel writing, because map makers were readers who wrote all kinds of stuff about what they read. They chose things to put on their maps. But as I worked the dissertation into a book, I realized that there was a much more important question here. The Renaissance was an era in which the European notion of what it meant to be human exploded. Whole new groups of people were encountered who had never heard the word of God. At the same time, there were these kind of classical theories of the kinds of beings you would find at the edges of the earth, where the climate was potentially harsh. They might be ontologically different. They might be monstrous. And what I realized looking at maps is that they participated in a unique way in this dilemma. You know, when you look at people who are different, are they just people who look a bit different, or are they somehow fundamentally different kinds of beings? Maps made that geographical grid of the world very visible. You could see very clearly if a group lived in some harsh, at a harsh latitude, like the poles or the equator. And they made those connections between geography, human diversity, and latitude very visible. So it seemed that there was a bigger book to be written about how we understand the concept of the human, and making the point that what counts as human, who counts as human, changes over time.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. So let me ask you this. In the beginning of the book, you talk about how Europeans explained human diversity. Now, they knew something about it before the do we still call it the Age of Exploration? I don't know what we call it. In any event, that thing where they traveled abroad, and this both East and West, I have to say, and they mm-hmm. found a lot of different kinds of folks. How did they grapple with this? What tools did they have? What did they think they already knew?
Many of the things they thought they already knew came out of ancient Greek and Roman writings, and also out of the Bible. And one of the main frameworks for thinking about human variety was this theory of bodily humors. So kind of, this is like an ancient classical way of thinking about how, you know, different things in the body are shaped by external climates, for example, how hot it is or how humid it is. Your humors are also shaped by the activities you do and the food you eat. And so the balance between those humors shape your mental aptitude and your character. But what that meant is if you moved individuals from place to place around the globe, theoretically they would change because different stars, different climates would be acting on them. Humoral theory made people in different places who look different, the same overall anyway. And this was the message in the Bible as well. Everyone was descended from Noah and Adam. And if you were descended from Adam, you were rational and capable of becoming Christian. So that was kind of one setup where everyone was kind of the same and only different on the surface. But there was another interpretation of life on Earth, and this was the notion of monstrous people. So kind of ontologically different beings who are different because they live in a climate that's so different that normal, quote unquote, minds and bodies, you know, can't exist there anymore. And this is the kind of writing you find in, say, works like Pliny's Natural History. Mm-hmm. You have these monsters, these category breakers, who are the wonders of nature in distant spaces. Now, the question is, of course, how far away do you need to be from where the climate is nice, i.e. Southern Europe, before you reach a land where only beings that are ontologically different can exist? In other words, when you traverse the whole Earth, that does beg the question, where is the boundary between human space and monster space. And this is the question that suddenly became of practical interest in the 16th century. Once you have, you know, your own country folk traveling around the world, you might actually be interested in whether their minds and bodies would degenerate in different places, whether the individuals you meet are degenerate in some way, perhaps in an invisible way in their minds, which you have to try and figure out from their bodies and behaviors. So two of the main ways of thinking about humanoid variety, if you will, on Earth was kind of the kind of humoral theory and the kind of biblical paradigm, whereby everyone was ultimately the same and only different on the surface, and the concept of monstrous peoples, whereby there were beings who might, say, have their heads in their shoulders, have only one giant leg to protect them from the sun, or live exclusively on a diet of smells. Those beings were fundamentally different physiologically, temperamentally. And yet, it's as if there was this boundary between human and monster that was sometimes not there. If you leant on this boundary the wrong way, you might actually go in. So perhaps if you moved to the wrong climate, you could eventually find your body changing so that you were no longer actually human. So that was the anxiety that was perhaps theoretical in the Middle Ages. But once you have the European circumnavigating the Earth, there is the question of whether you are now in those spaces where monstrosity happens. And while this may sound very fanciful, it's the way astrobiologists think today about life in other galaxies. None of us expect life, on a planet around Alpha Centauri to look like life on Earth, because the climate is different. So my Renaissance scholars are not thinking with any less rationality than we do about how far you need to get from us before you actually turn into different species.
I do wonder, though, if you could speak a little bit further about the way Christian writers and theorists and pamphleteers explain the appearance of all of these peoples that are not mentioned in the Bible, in places that are not mentioned in the Bible, and who don't exactly look like, well, the people that they imagined were in the Bible. How did they account for these new worlds?
Indeed. There were some indirect explanations that medieval and Renaissance scholars could get out of scripture. For example, it was possible that beings who were very different were the result of some kind of degeneration, some kind of divine punishment. For example, the descendants of Cain who killed his brother Abel, or Ham jeered at his father Noah when he came across him drunk. There were supposed to have been divine curses that deformed their kin. So if you ran into a monstrous being, they may be monstrous because they are the progeny of someone who sinned in a fundamental way.
I don't want to revisit the entire debate as to whether the people they found were human or not, or whether they were, the word I want to use is whether they could be saved or not.
Saved.
Yes. Salvable. I don't know what this one say.
Capable of salvation.
Salvation, yeah. But maybe you could talk a little bit about just that discourse, about how they grappled with this problem of these, either fallen people or people that had not met Christ, how they might be brought into the fold, what could be done along the lines of saving their souls.
One of the kind of anxieties in, for example, 16th century Mexican Peru under kind of Spanish rule was indeed this very question: how can you bring these people to salvation? And also, what does it mean if you cannot bring them to salvation? One of the challenges, of course, was that the very process of encounter was catastrophic for native populations in the Americas. Not only did diseases like smallpox, wipe out large quantities of people quickly, but the processes of forced labor and enslavement created much crisis as we can imagine. So the kind of missionaries in the Americas were, you know, there are the two sides of this argument. Either these peoples are incapable of salvation. How do we know this? One, they're not converting. Two, look at their nasty practices of human sacrifice, idolatry, sodomy, and so on. But on the other side, there was the argument that, well, we're treating them so badly. Of course they don't want to convert to our religion. What is in there for them? So right from the beginning, you have missionaries, colonial administrators, conquistadors looking at outward appearance and behavior and whether or not people have, you know, kind of cities or fine technological skills like metalworking, and trying to go from observables like that to divining what people's minds are like. And therein lies the entire kind of challenge of figuring out whether people are savable. You can't see into their mind. You can only go from their kind of external behaviors and bodies and make, you know, judgments that even at the time people knew were subjective, problematic. People had different agendas, which would, you know, it might prompt them to pull out some kinds of evidence and not others.
Mm-hmm. So one of the, again, you've led me right to the next topic. One of the strange behaviors that they thought they saw, and maybe they did see, was cannibalism.
Indeed.
And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Certainly. Cannibalism was the very first motif that you started to see on maps of the Americas. So it's the very first emblematic thing that mapmakers pull out. Did that mean that cannibalism happened? Well, that is quite a fraught question. One of the problems that there is for figuring out what really happened in the colonial world is that very few scholars are conversant with the enormous range of sources that survive, everything from European sources through to indigenous oral testimony. You can go and, you know, speak to people from today in the Caribbean islands, the place where cannibalism was first written about. And then there are, you know, kind of bone evidence as well, which kind of forensic anthropologists know about. And of course, today we're very aware that a lot of European texts were written by people who very much wanted to legitimize activities they were participating in, whether it was enslaving native peoples or taking over their territory. But the consensus among the anthropologists is that, yes, there was some ritual cannibalism in various parts of the Americas, as well as in other parts of the world, including, say, the south of France. So this the veracity doesn't seem to be in doubt, although we can be sure that it didn't happen every single time that somebody said it did. Go on.
I was going to say, what did the Europeans make of this?
That, strangely enough, depends a little bit on who you ask. Typically, in the earlier sources about the Caribbean, the writings by people who accompanied, you know, kind of Columbus or Vespucci, there is writing about all kinds of different people that the expedition met. There were the peaceful Taino, then there were the supposedly cannibalistic groups like the Caribs or the Tupi. While this is usually seen as a sign of people that are who are reprehensible, in the mid-16th century, the French Huguenot traveler Jean de Léry wrote a very sympathetic ethnographic account of the Tupinambá people of Brazil, who were one of the groups who engaged in ritual cannibalism. And he pointed out that, in fact, these people lived perhaps in harmony with nature, people who read Léry's account took some of those arguments further. Michel de Montaigne famously said, yeah. Well, you know, the cannibals, they don't have envy, they don't have jealousy. These are perhaps the sort of people that we, living in, you know, an age of religious reformation and crisis in Europe, might usefully emulate. We here cut up, you know, bodies and hang them up for display because we don't like the religion of the person in front of us. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Brazilian cannibals are much more respectful with the individuals they are subject to ritual cannibalism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did anyone take the further step of saying, as Protestant critics of Catholicism sometimes did, and I think we're doing just at this time, that essentially every Catholic, if he believes what he says he believes, or she believes what she says she believes, is a cannibal, because transubstantiation being what it is means yes. That you're in fact eating Christ?
Absolutely. So this is the dilemma for Catholic commentators. How much can you demonize individuals kind of eating human flesh when, you know, if you are devout, you feel you are doing it yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. That's a tough one for them. How did they deal with it? Did they just avoid it, or did they, this is different somehow? Special exemption?
There's a certain amount of avoidance. I suppose it isn't as if murder or various crimes weren't, you know, they... Crimes were crimes, and I suppose sure. The kind of engagement with the divine is engaging with a different ontological being who is, you know,
right.
Superhuman.
Special exception. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, that, it's not an inconsistent argument, I don't think. another thing you talk about is the and I'm very interested in these monsters, Patagonia's giants. Can you tell us about Patagonia's giants? How do Patagonia get giants? I don't associate with Patagonia with giants.
Well, in fact, they've been associated with giants for centuries. As late as the early 20th century, there was a French monograph of scientific writing about whether or not they were giants. The Patagonians are perhaps one of my favorite examples in the book. So in the 1520s, the Magellan expedition sets out for Asia, going west, and ends up parking themselves for a while in Southeast South America, where they meet people who are tall. That's sort of it. And you have there are a couple of early 16th century accounts that were printed at the time, one by someone on the voyage, a certain Antonio Pigafetta, who wrote this long account of the Magellan voyage. And he talked about how they had seen, for example, a man as large as a giant. You know, and so this guy is a man. But as you read through the account, the man as large as a giant slowly slips into being a giant. But, you know, what we don't know from the travel accounts and what a reader couldn't tell is whether these were just a few one-offs or whether they, you know, they might just be normal people who are a bit tall. They may be a few people who were had some kind of medical problem, but there was no clear sense of whether everybody in Patagonia was a giant, whether they might be an entire monstrous people caused by the climate being very, very harsh. It was a, you know, very southern land. What happens when mapmakers get hold of the travel accounts and start devising, you know, a motif for the peoples of the America of Patagonia, is that suddenly you have these documents, these maps, which emblematize Patagonia by monstrous peoples, by people they describe as giants found by the Spaniards, for example. And the way in which readers in the 16th century read ethnographic imagery on maps is to assume that the mapmaker chose things that everybody had in common in that region. So if what everybody in Patagonia has in common is being a giant, and you see that word in all the captions, gigantes, then this is no longer a kind of one-off pathology of, you know, three people who are too tall. This is a group who is ontologically different. And then you have to wonder why they are so tall. What is it that has made them ontologically distinctive? And you see travelers like André Tauvé and scholars like Jean Baudin speculating on why the Patagonians are giants. And one of the examples, one of the explanations given is that they were actually cannibals from further north who migrated to the south and then acquired this new monstrification, if you will, under that climate. So that kind of reasoning shows how travelers and scholars are open to the possibility that as you move to different latitudes, your body may well change. You may become another sort of species.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So essentially, you begin with a iffy observation and you turn that into a premise that then gets substantiated by some pictorial means, that is the giant standing for a place, then it's assumed into fact by somebody like Jean Baudin, whose name I hadn't heard for a long time, but I was glad to hear it. And then we have speculation on why it's so, even though it isn't. You see what
exactly,
I mean?
Exactly. The map makers are pretty important. You know, yeah. You find them drawing children on the maps. You have baby giants with much bigger heads next to grown up giants. You see male and female giants. So once you have one of each, that does suggest that they can create more giants.
Yeah. Skepticism was born in the Renaissance, but it didn't really flourish there. I can say that. So let's move on to another couple of these. I'm just fascinated by these. They're not exactly monsters. I mean, in the etymological sense of the word, I guess they are Amazons. I don't even know if people know in the age of Amazon what an Amazon actually is anymore, if you see what I mean. So maybe you can explain that it's not a company that sells every kind of crap. TV, or even a river.
Indeed, that is true. Before the Amazon was a river, before the Amazon was even a Amazons were a people described in classical antiquity, this group of warrior women who cut off one breast so that they could more easily draw their arm backwards in order to shoot arrows. So the Amazons were this group of warrior women. And in the late 16th century, they start to reappear in travel writing, but this time travel writing about Northeast South America, about in the region that became known as Amazonia.
Right. So, but here's a case where we, now maybe I'm going to overstate this or oversell it. We know nobody ever saw this. There's no doubt about it. There's no way they saw anything like this.
Well, it depends on what you say.
I knew you'd say that.
Now, if an Amazon is a if Amazon simply means warlike woman who shoots with bows and arrows, there's no reason. You see, there's no reason they shouldn't have seen such people. And what we know from ethnohistorical sources, there were certainly tribes who talked to various European visitors about warlike women, and this could simply have been matrilineal societies where women were also participating in. And of course, if you are a 16th century traveler and you have set off to the far west, which will eventually become the distant east on a round world, you are carrying ideas that you already have about what may be found at the edges of the earth. And so a tribe where kind of women are shooting with bows and arrows is intrinsically plausible. And we do have accounts of not just Amazons, but also people who allegedly had no heads that we know were part of the oral culture and of tribes in the Amazon who, may have been able to convey some of these ideas to Europeans. So there's no need to assume Europeans made stuff up. They could have misread what they were seeing with their eyes, or they may have been in conversation with native peoples about who they thought lived, far away from them.
Yeah, I guess my point is that they may have been given this information that there was, in fact, this tribe of women warriors by the natives. That's entirely possible. But they loved that story, and they ran with it. That's the kind of interesting part.
This is certainly one that was very important for Walter Raleigh, for example.
Yeah.
And one can't help wondering whether, I mean, if you're hearing about a lot of different things, what things are you going to choose to put in your travel account? And perhaps it was, you know, choosing a kind of warrior, kind of a female kind of warrior people was an elliptical way of flattering his female monarch.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it it served his or their interests so well, but there's something about this story that not only they, but even we find kind of compelling and fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's a good one for us. I don't know what they thought of it, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you mentioned these headless men. I have personally never seen a headless man. Not one that's alive. I've not even seen one that's dead, except on TV.
I have to concede that I haven't either.
Okay. I'm glad of that, I think. But could you tell us a little bit about the headless men that they report?
So Walter Raleigh talks about two kinds of people that then mapmakers pick up. One is the Amazons, and one is these people whose heads are beneath their shoulders. It may be that people like Raleigh kind of traveling saw giant shields on which heads were painted that led them to think, oh, here are some people with their heads in a really weird place. So that is the possible kind of visual cue for this kind of thinking. Again, the story circulating among indigenous peoples include those of people whose heads are below their shoulders. So that also may be one of the stimulators of this being. What interests me in particular about the headless beings is that they don't seem to have been intrinsically unbelievable in Elizabethan England. The reason I say that is that Raleigh talks about these headless people, the Iwipanoma, whom he didn't meet, but he met, you know, 20 different kinds of people who met them, some of whom came to England. So he's suggesting you could interview them themselves, yourself. But he wrote up a manuscript with his travel account, took it to his sponsor, who then edited it to make sure it put Raleigh in the best light. See, Raleigh wanted to raise money for another voyage in search of gold in Guyana, which he hadn't quite managed to find. So two people who were kind of editing Raleigh's account for credibility did not delete anything to do with the headless people of Guyana. There were other things that Raleigh's sponsor, so William Cecil, removed, Robert Cecil, such as accounts of the bacchanalian distractions of Guyana for drunkards, for womanizers. He removed references to small green stones, but everything to do with Amazons and headless people remained, which suggests that the idea that people who were ontologically different lived in the tropics, near the equator, was perfectly plausible, just as for us, if life was found, in a distant galaxy, we'd be much more surprised if it looked like us than if it turned out to be a gas or something.
I guess. Yeah. Jumping Jack Flash. You make a very good point about that. That's a very good point. I had never considered it in that light, but we would be surprised if they looked like us.
Mm-hmm.
We really would. So heretofore, we've been talking about, I don't know how we talk about these people anymore, tribal people. I'm not sure. People that generally didn't have cities and all the accoutrements of cities and the way people live in cities. The Mexicans and the Peruvians did, though.
Mm-hmm.
They were much more like the Europeans that encountered them. How did the ethnographers and map makers deal with them?
First kind of writings we have about Mexico and Peru came from people who traveled with the conquistadors. And what you see in these accounts is people who are very awestruck by the cities of Tenochtitlan, today's Mexico City, but kind of cities like Cuzco and Casamaja in Peru. They draw comparisons between the types of architecture they see in Mexico and Peru with the remains of ancient Roman architecture and say things like, oh, well, you know, this city is as good as anything that the Romans built. So you have a lot of admiration of architecture and also of certain other technological skills like metalworking. What you see also in these texts is descriptions of practices that the Europeans found less admirable, such as human sacrifice, such as what they called idolatry or worshipping idols, worshipping the wrong god, sodomy, you know, having children with your close relatives, for example. While maps show for other regions those elements that made those people look very different from Europeans. So the Patagonians are giants, the Brazilians are cannibals. For Mexico and Peru, mapmakers chose not to highlight those things that made these people seem very different, but rather those elements that made those people seem more like Europeans. For both Mexico and Peru, it was the cities and, you know, the presence of leaders and organized societies that mapmakers emblemized those regions with. And I think the reason for all this is what mapmakers were trying to do is create documents that helped you to tell one region from another. They needed to make these regions memorable and distinctive. And once you have cannibalism in Brazil, human sacrifice, iconographically, isn't going to look that different. So even though, say, for Mexico, the kind of very first kind of letter that gets printed widely, a letter by Hernan Cortes, included this map of Tenochtitlan with a little plan in the middle of where human sacrifice happens, later maps didn't take that little detail from the middle. They just drew the architectural bit of the city. And you could say, well, that's because there wasn't enough room on the maps. And practicalities also come in. But the choices that you see mapmakers making as they pick emblems for North and South America are the ones that help you tell that region from another, which does two jobs for the mapmaker. Firstly, it shows they actually are reading something new. So if a new region has been explored, how do you show that you are up to date by taking something from that new text that isn't in any of the old ones for the other regions? And secondly, why would you have a map at all? A large map with images and descriptions of peoples inside it help you by giving you a visual aid that you can refer to as you read these, you know, convoluted travel texts about different parts of the world. So what map makers were selling is not their own personal eyewitness experience, but their work as cultural arbiters who carefully collated and synthesized and evaluated the testimony of all of these tricksy witnesses in different parts of the world and passed that through all the scientific knowledge, you know, classical texts and whatnot. And that is one of the reasons I think that you have that consistent choice across map makers in the German lands, in the Low Countries and elsewhere, of showing cities for the peoples of Mexico. Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in the, I'm not quite sure of what word to use for it, the critical moment here, or the moment at which some of this evidence begins to be sifted in a more critical way. I know that when I was studying these texts, there was a kind of proto-explorer of Russia. His name was Herberstein, and he wrote a famous book, Rerum Moscovitacarum, and pretty much everything in it, whether it was true or false, was then copied by the people that came after him until, and there are some exceptions here, some predecessors, a man named Adam Olearius wrote what is both a description of Russia but also a critical commentary on Herberstein. And it says, Herberstein was right here and Herberstein was wrong here. And I have no idea where Herberstein got this. I think he was making it up. And everybody who has repeated it since has just been fooled. This happens in about 1650. Are there similar people among the map makers and ethnographers that you studied who say, yeah, well, maybe not. This just seems to be made up. The evidence is weak. It's been repeated a bunch of times, but that doesn't make it true. Are there such people you found?
Yes, and I would say that even before kind of Europeans are sailing west across the Atlantic, there is evidence of map makers not only kind of sifting evidence and being skeptical and trying to figure out whether what a traveler has said is true or not, but actually writing those conversations down on their maps. And one example is this mid-15th century Venetian mapmaker, Fra Mauro, and I wrote an article about his mid-15th century map. On that map, he talks about the concept of the almost incredible. He, he says, here are some things that are almost incredible. So they break the kind of boundaries of what we know through our own eyes. But we would expect that kind of phenomena in distant parts of the world. And from Fra Mauro's map, which is, about 8 meters by 8 meters, this splendid manuscript, is covered in writing. There are a couple of great facsimiles and editions covered in writing. And he talks about, what he decided to write about. He says, for example, I've decided to refrain from speaking about all sorts of novelties and customs, the diversity of animals. I don't have room for everything, so I'm only going to talk about the most unusual problematic things on my map so that we can have a discussion. This is a map where the map maker is quite open about uncertainty. He talks about who some of his sources are. Some were travelers who went to the East and came to Florence. He talks about meeting the occasional person from Africa. And he comes out occasionally and says, here are all the things I've found. But, I can't bear witness to this myself. And I quote, I leave the research to those who are curious to learn such novelties. Mm-hmm. So the whole map is full of kind of epistemological musings and upfrontness about the challenges. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, there's a very old saying that, people who are very old or who have traveled far could lie with impunity because the rest of us can't test, their claims. And this is certainly something that even in the Middle Ages, there are examples of mapmakers and geographers thinking this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess I'm just struck by the, I want to say naivete, but really it's a kind of lack of thoroughgoing skepticism on these parts. Their willingness to believe what the travelers say, that is they being the map makers, and to put things that they've never seen in any of their experience, or maybe they've heard about them in classical texts, but by 1500 there was plenty of skepticism about what was in classical texts. Mm-hmm. I just find it kind of, I guess they were just very open-minded.
I suppose they hadn't traveled somewhere. People had come back from sailing west. They even came back with new peoples and animals.
They did. That's true.
Think about it. Once you have extraordinary, animals in your kind of menageries, it's not that unlikely that there are unusual people either. And both Jean de Léry, mid-16th century French traveler, and Sir Walter Raleigh talk about how before they traveled, they were skeptical. And, given the wonders that they already saw, even ancient sources looked more plausible. And, of course, skepticism about ancient sources was in some ways easy because the ancient sources themselves contradicted one another. So what was the size of a degree? Well, it depends on who you are. So they themselves were this enormous panoply of voices claiming things that were sometimes contradictory. If you were a map maker, you had never really traveled to the places you were mapping. So you were, either you recorded and synthesized the information that was coming to you, or you had nothing. And in the end, there was ritual cannibalism among, the Caribs and the Tupi. So what they're showing was indeed what there was. Mm-hmm. the forensic evidence shows that the Tehuelche people of southern South America were taller than the average European would have been. I mean, they might only have been around 6 foot, 6 foot two, but if you were a desperately poor person who went out and became a sailor, you might be 5 foot tall. Now, how much taller than average do you have to be before you're ontologically different? Now, that's an interesting question, and you see people talking about that. Are they tall enough to be monstrous, or are they not? But even, you know, many centuries later, you know, you have this issue of, well, if you have an individual who is quite different, is there a point at which they become a pathology? And at that point, do they have a different legal status?
Sure, sure.
There was an Irish giant of the late 18th century called...
I was going to mention this guy. Yeah,
Charles Byrne. And he performed his giantness at fairs. He was about 8 feet tall. He died young. A heart can't pump through all that body. Mm-hmm. He had left instructions in his will that he wanted a sea burial. He didn't want to be displayed after his death. He left money for this sea burial. But after he died, his body was sold and put on display.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I checked, about a year and a half ago in London, you could still go and see his skeleton for free in the museum in the Royal College of Surgeons in central London. And next to his skeleton is a label telling you the story and saying he did not wish to be displayed after his death. So what is it about Charles Byrne that means it's okay even now to disregard his wishes for not being exhibited after his death? Clearly, he has crossed some kind of ontological boundary of tallness where, you know, he's no longer someone who we wish we were as tall as, but he's someone who automatically almost doesn't get treated the same as everyone else.
What is it about the Royal College of Surgeons that makes them keep the body? That's what I want to know. What is
well,
with these people?
The skeleton. The museum there, I'm blanking on the name, I think maybe called the Hunterian, or that may be the one in the Glasgow. The museum is full of specimens that were collected, you know, various sorts of individuals who had, you know, too many fingers, too many limbs, animal and human fetuses. And the museum was meant as a pedagogical tool. But there comes a point where it's very difficult to say where pedagogy ends and voyeurism kind of begins.
Yeah, voyeurism. I just wanted to talk to you for a second about what I might call the bat boy hypothesis and all this. And I'm not a big fan of the bat boy hypothesis. For those of you who don't know, the bat boy was reportedly discovered by someone in the National Enquirer, which is a tabloid in the United States. And bat boy, you know, is basically a freak of nature. And he's definitely crossed all kinds of ontological boundaries. He has really sharp teeth and bat ears and so on and so forth. Of course, it's all made up, but it sold a lot of newspapers, really a lot of newspapers. And as I say, I'm not a big fan of this hypothesis when it comes to these Renaissance ethnographers, but one must entertain the possibility that they were sticking these incredibly improbable monsters on their maps because it sold maps.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible? Or should we believe that? I don't, but go ahead.
It is possible, but there were two types of audiences and two types of spins for a map maker. And one was that you were providing sober, accurate, carefully synthesized information. And the other thing they could think about doing was to appeal to people's interest in all things sensational. And they had to tack adroitly between these two. These two options. There is some correspondence surviving of geographers and printers having arguments with each other. For example, this German printer called Gruninger, who produced some of the German cannibal mapping from the early 16th century. And there are scholars who wrote in and complained, saying, you know, Gruninger loves to put these images in. And then at the same time, you have accounts, sometimes things written on maps themselves, saying, I'm putting these in because scholars appreciate seeing them. So it's never very, it wasn't a clear-cut case that adding monstrous iconography would help sales. They might, you know, if it was some giant geographical tome in Latin, the audience for this would have been people like scholars or people who wanted to show how educated they were. So if your monstrosities didn't appear to have a basis in experience, that might backfire. And of course, experience here, if it means travelers who went somewhere far away that no one else can test, as a geographer, that's the best you can do. And there were a few compendia where individual monstrous beings like the headless men of Guiana and the Amazons, where printers would print some of that information and then add beneath it a little digests of all of the potential textual antecedents and backups for the choice of these beings. If we had spaceships going to distant places and bringing beings back, I suppose we would now have videos and photographs. But if you didn't have photography and you didn't have videos and all the creatures or some of them died on the way back, you would have to take a lot on trust or know nothing. And of course, when you have fabulous animals like armadillos coming back and extraordinary plants, not to mention plenty of indigenous visitors who dressed differently, talked differently, it wasn't much of a jump from that to Patagonian giants or Brazilian cannibals, especially perhaps for Protestants seeing seeing Catholics kind of symbolically eating their god anyway.
All right, I have a final question. I think it's the 500th anniversary of Thomas More's Utopia. The people who listen to this podcast know all about Thomas More's Utopia because we have the best educated listenership in the world. It seems to me that a lot of what you have written bears on what might have been. Historians don't like might have been, but might have been in Thomas More's mind when he wrote Utopia. Now, no one has ever figured out what was in his mind because the book is so strange. You know, did he intend it to be believed? Was it kind of arch social commentary? Did he base it on any sort of actual travel accounts? Did he believe some of it? What can you shed any light on this in the 500th? Anniversary of Thomas More's Utopia?
Well, 1517 is earlier than almost all of the maps in my study.
Yep.
So put that out there first.
Okay.
But by 1517, you do have travel accounts from the Caribbean that are suggesting that perhaps this is the terrestrial paradise. And so this is the big contradiction about the distant East. Not only is this a space where you might find monstrous bodies and behaviors, but this is also where paradise was, the earthly paradise.
Right.
So you might say that the kind of this Western traverse to that region where paradise was expected to be might well have been one of the things circulating in Moore's mind.
Yeah, I don't know either. I really, this is just something that I've been thinking about recently because I'm a big fan of the book, and I know that people still today don't, I don't know they really know how to read it. I think maybe you and I do, but we're early modernists. It gives us a particular advantage. But then again, maybe I'm just fooling myself and I don't know how to read it. I don't know. Anyway, Sarika, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today and for having written a terrific book.
Thank you.
And I want to close our interview by asking our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
I have two next book projects. The main one I call Collecting Artifacts in the Age of Empire. I'm interested in how exotic objects from the Americas and the Pacific ended up in European cabinets of curiosities and early museums. And by looking at how people wrote about them and classified them, I'm interested in how the concept of the European was invented alongside a concept of, an indigenous person who has no technology. So the invention of this idea that Europeans have technology and there's some kind of indigenousness that doesn't. by looking at objects. That's the main project. But something that fell out of the first book and demands to be written as his own is something I call Before Frankenstein, A Cultural History of Europe Through Monsters. Right. And this would go from the Middle Ages to Frankenstein and look at how we can tell the history of Europe differently by looking at the Age of Exploration, the Age of Reformation, and notions of science and enlightenment through category breakers, be they the monstrous animals that reformers like Martin Luther said were signs that God was unhappy with the papacy, through to kind of individual monstrous births studied by scientific societies like the Royal Society. And by the time of Frankenstein, of course, you have people wondering whether there's a point at which human behavior can become so powerful that humans are pushing at that boundary between the human and the divine, and whether that's actually a very bad thing, resulting in, of course, Frankenstein's monster. Mm-hmm. So those are the two spaces into which my original conversations are now going.
All right, great. Yep. Oh, those sound super interesting, and I trust that when you're done with them, which will be very soon, right? That was a joke.
Yeah, you know, in geological time.
Yes, it'll be tomorrow. That you'll come back and talk to us about those books.
That sounds great.
All right, good. Well, again, let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Sarika Davis about her terrific book, Renaissance Ethnography and the Invention of the Human, New Worlds, Maps, and Monsters. And it was published by Cambridge University Press. And let me also say, shout out to Cambridge University Press, because it's a beautiful book. You know, they did a really good job. I look at a lot of these books, Sarika, and I can tell you they did a really nice job on your book.
Mm-hmm. They'll be pleased to hear that.
Well, they did. They did a great job. It's absolutely beautiful. The prints are great. Everything is great about it. So, let me say to everyone who listens to this show, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being your host today, and I hope that you listen in again soon.